Okay, I'm supposed to qualify. I'm eminently qualified to be here. I drank until the wheels came off. I drank until the last dog died. I had not always been drinking like a pig and swimming in an ocean of whiskey, but that's where I was when I got here. And through no plan of my own, utterly bleak and hopeless and dying and sliding off the edge of the world, you wackos caught me. And it was all over. You hadn't been on my planning screen that morning, and that night I was totally ready. So been amongst you ever since. It works. There's a birthday board up here for September sobriety anniversaries. I would encourage any of you newer folks to take a look at it tonight after the meeting. It is living proof that this deal works. So glad you're all here tonight. Our speaker tonight, Chuck D, is an old and valued friend of mine. I haven't heard Chuck speak since the summer of '92, which I've wanted to hear the son of a gun speak since then. But I determined that when I got this little commitment for September, that I was going to hear Chucky D speak again. It's 19 years later, hard to believe. He and his best friend, Bill Oakley, made quite a pair and quite a mark on my life at a very significant time in my life. And I spent many hours sitting out on his pier by his boathouse on Lake Killarney, bleeding while he and Bill Oakley threw bandages and gauze and band-aids on me. I hadn't drunk and I hadn't scraped myself up physically, but I was sure bleeding. And by hook or by crook, that little girl came back to me, and you all know her as Nina. So it's my pleasure to introduce my friend Chuck.
Hello, everybody. I'm Chuck. I'm an alcoholic. I got started out right for a change, huh? Last time I spoke, they went on like Mike did today, and I thought maybe somebody else was supposed to be speaking here. It sounds so good. I've been thinking about a lot of things here. I hope I can keep things in order a little bit for you. My sobriety date is yesterday. It's 28 years. And I've got a couple of lady friends, one of whom is here tonight, who matched that time closely, this Vicky, and Nina as well. So the whiskey business took a hell of a hit. All my AA teachings and development have been in Central Florida. I didn't find this group right away. It would have been much better had I. One of the things for you new people to maybe understand is that when somebody gets up here, usually they talk about a lot of stuff they did wrong. And I remember one time when I had been to one of these when I was new, and I was with a lady who I drank with and who I later married. And I told her, I says, you know, all those people do is they get up there and talk about all the mistakes they made. If I ever get a chance to get up there, I'm going to talk about all the things I did right. She said, oh, and what would that be? She had my number, didn't she? I want to pass along a little tip that my sponsor, Bill O, gave me that I gave to a young lady recently, and she tried it. And she was talking at her first meeting, and she was nervous, and Bill had told me about this trick. He said, you just start talking, and eventually you'll say something that somebody finds interesting, and they'll go like this. They'll nod. Once you spot that person, you can talk to that person for the rest of the meeting. It works out very nicely if you do that, because they relate. So I tried that. The very first time I tried it, I was speaking down in the basement of the Presbyterian Church downtown. And there was a big black guy in the back row. And he had a beautiful set of white teeth. And he started nodding right away when I started talking. And then he smiled. And I said, man, have I got a target. I talked to him the rest of the meeting. But I'll have to get drunk for a little while first here, and then we'll get sober. Let's see. I was like so many of you, probably almost everybody here. The first time I met alcohol, I found a dear missing friend, a young teenager, and she's nodding. And she has nice teeth. So, anyway, there's nothing really unusual about my initial dealings with alcohol other than the fact I was an alcoholic. I just loved it. I couldn't imagine why anybody wouldn't want to drink the way I drank. And it was just such a marvelous feeling. So the years went by, and by the way, there was one person in my life who didn't like to drink at all, and it was my mother. And she insisted that she was allergic to alcohol. Can you believe that? Yes, you can, can't you? So I came up along. I had three older brothers. Two of them died alcoholic-related deaths. The other one married young, and his wife told him to choose between her and the booze. And the rest of us always thought he made a mistake. He chose her. But be that as it may, that was a familial situation. And I was aware long before I got here that I was an alcoholic. But it wasn't that bad, right? It wasn't that bad. I should nod, Jim. So the time went by. School was easy for me. I came from a very academic kind of family, and I could do just about as well as I wanted to, which was just enough to get where I wanted to go. I got through high school, college, postgraduate school. I got then some training after that, and everything went along about the way most other guys were, except for this alcohol thing. It was always rearing its ugly head. Came very close to getting me in major trouble, but I always managed to get by. When I was in postgraduate school, I got drunk and disorderly, spent the night in jail, and oh boy, I was afraid they were going to find out about that at the college. Yeah, if they did, they never did anything about it. I don't know what would happen today with better communications, probably, between the sheriff's department and the dean's office. But I managed to do all right. I never got a DUI. I got stopped by the cops many times when I've been drinking, but I learned some tricks that you all have known too. And when I was finishing up my main schooling, there was a lady that I liked, and so we got married because it was the right time for both of us to get married. That was really quite funny. For a while, and then it really wasn't quite funny. But we had three wonderful children, which play a part in my recovery. I probably forget to tell you later, so I can just tell you now that my kids were so ashamed of their dad, and I knew that, and it just ate me up, because I had a big enough ego, so I didn't want kids that didn't like me. And I had kids that didn't like me. Not anymore. In case, when got this trip, the schooling got done, I came down to Florida. And I started making a little money so I could stop drinking beer, and I started drinking whiskey, and of course I drank the whiskey like I drank the beer. That didn't work out very well. I think I was blessed with a weak stomach, because I never could drink beer in industrial quantities like my buddies did. I would try, and then I'd have to excuse myself and go, you know what? Then I'd come back and drink some more. But I never could handle that quantity. I think it maybe was a protective measure that my body had for some reason. But anyway, now I'm drinking the whiskey. Now things I can drink. All I want to, I won't get any problem with my stomach. Wrong. And later the stomach started acting up again against the whiskey. But during that time, I had some very interesting experiences. And I want to tell you this first one, because it's the reason I'm here tonight, I think. Mike really wanted to hear this story again. So, here it goes. One of the things that I really liked to do a lot when I was in the drinking days was to find some strange woman. That is to say, strange, not strange to me, but strange to my wife. And meet her in some town, not Orlando, and go to some hotel and just basically stay in that room for however long we were going to be there. Everything I wanted was in that room. So, a lot of drinking. And one Saturday night was really bad. I mean, really bad. I got so, so bad. I remember that I actually put a chair propped up against the door on the inside to keep me from going out. Because we were up on a balcony in a hotel, one of these big central atria, you know, and they had a wrought iron fence that was about this tall. Would have been real easy even for a little guy like me to fall over that thing. So I knew how dangerous I was that Saturday night. But when I woke up, I was so feeling so bad. And I called the bell captain right away, and I said, bring up a quart of vodka and the Sunday paper up to our room right away. He doesn't come. An hour, he arrives. I said, my God, man, I thought you were never going to get here. I guess it's hard to get vodka here in Atlanta on Sundays, huh? He says, no, but it's hard to get a Sunday paper on Monday. Because it sounded a little like a blackout drinker. Huh? There are a lot of them like that. Those were actually the highlights of my life. Those were the things that I lived for. Wow. So, finally, that wife had enough of me, and she unloaded me. And I moved into this guarded community, not a prison, but one with, county sheriff guys, part-time off-duty cops taking care of the gate, which is significant for a little story I'll tell you later. So I move in there, and I'm not there very long. I got divorced in 78, 79. I met this woman. And she was the first woman I'd ever met that drank like I did. I'm sure there are a lot of them in this room that did, but I didn't meet you. Lucky you. And so we got involved very quickly with each other, and our alcoholism accelerated mutually very rapidly. And we tried to cut down. One time we actually quit drinking for a couple of months, and then we decided to celebrate. You know how that works out. Celebrating anything for an alcoholic always works out bad in my case. So anyway, the first significant thing really that, and by the way, when I was living in that covered community, that sheltered community, that guarded community, one night I went to a Christmas party in a place about 3 weeks away from where I'm 3 weeks. Yeah, it could be 3 weeks. 3 blocks away from where I live. And I was just usual. I performed my usual manner, and I really got drunk. And I decided it was time to go home. So I got in my big Lincoln, and I started driving home the 3 blocks, and I got lost. And I found myself driving down the street, puzzled, where am I going? And I saw this house on the right-hand side. I remember this so well. And I recognized this. Oh, yeah, now I know where I am. That house should be on the other side of the street if I were going the right way. I got to turn around. I'll turn around. That house has a circular driveway. I'll just drive in there, turn around, and go back the other way. So I pull in there, and they don't have a circular driveway. So something tells me to look in the backyard. So I drive my big car alongside the house on grass down in the backyard. And I drive along through the pine trees and avoid most of the azaleas. And there isn't any circular driveway there. At least not until I leave. So finally I come to this great big azalea bush, and I say, I'm done. I'm not going anymore. I've had enough. I just sat there. And don't you know, those people were having a Christmas party that night. And the lights are flickering on, and the people looking out, what the hell is a car doing in our backyard? And after a minute or two, I realized, she goes, they're going to call the cops. So my clever alcoholic mind, all of which you have also, said, why don't you do the only reasonable thing that a man would do? And I did. I slid over into the passenger seat. So the cops come, sure enough, one on either side, you know, shining their little lights in there, looking in there. What are you doing? Nothing. How'd you get here? I came along the side of the house. Yeah, but I mean, what have you been doing tonight? He said, well, I say, well, I went to this Christmas party, excuse me. And I had too much to drink. And this man there volunteered to drive me home. And that's all I know. And the cops say, well, who was this man? I said, I don't know. He volunteered to drive me home. And, well, where is he? I don't know, he left. So you could get away with that kind of crap in those days, you know. You know, the cops, they drove me home and my car home, and I made amends to the backyard of my neighbor the next night. Interesting, interestingly enough, I should tell you this later, but I probably forget, so I'll tell you now. I have long since moved away from that community 25 years ago, and but I see this neighbor, a real nice lady that lived next door. I see her once in a while, I just bump into her. And you know how people are so forgiving about things after you straighten up and fly right. And but she remembered that incident. And she heard about it secondhand. She never heard about it from me, I promise you. And she says, you know that deal you had driving around in that backyard up there years ago? I said, yeah. She said, who was driving? You don't think I told her, do you? Anyway, I'll get way in. So. So this wonderful lady, Patricia was her name, who is long since deceased, I'll tell you about that. But she went to a party one Saturday afternoon in 1981, and some guy came up to her and said, "You know, Patricia, I've been watching the way you drink, and you drink like I drink, and I'm an alcoholic. You want to do something about your drinking?" Miracle number one, she says, "Yeah." He says, "Well, I know some ladies that don't drink anymore, and they're very happy, and they belong to this outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like me to call them?" Miracle two, yes. He calls. I don't know this man. I don't think she ever saw him again, and I certainly didn't. And that night, I took her to her first AA meeting, which she desperately needed. And the miracle number three was, as she left, of course, all of this is what she told me, as she left, the guy came up to her and said, "I hope this works for you, Patricia. It didn't work for me." Isn't that something? Here's a guy sharing the message, helping other people, when it isn't even helping him. Wow. Sounds suspiciously like a higher power is involved there somewhere. So anyway, well, you can imagine what happened then. I'm starting to get this little tickle. She started going to these meetings, and I found out that they started out with no drinking. And that certainly seemed radical to me. I mean, isn't that being a little extreme? No drinking? They didn't think it was extreme at all. And but she did that. She didn't drink, and I lost my drinking pal. So I tried to figure out how to get her out of there. And I couldn't come up with much. Finally, I came up with a brilliant idea. And I told her, I said, "Patricia, you know, this is a very serious situation you have here. You're doing group therapy, and the people you're doing it with are not licensed." She didn't buy that crap anymore, either. So I couldn't drag her out, so she dragged me in, and screaming. And she told me I would go to AA or I'd take a hike. It was AA or amen for me. So I started going to a meeting every week, once a week, under the gun. I didn't stop drinking. I didn't tell the guys I'd stopped drinking. I just said, "I'm Chuck, I'm an alcoholic, and I pass." And that went on for 2 years. And Mike, thanks for reminding me of this next part. This little Irishman comes up to me every Monday night, starting right near the beginning. He says, "Hiya, Chuck. You had enough?" Oh, boy, did I get tired of hearing that. Over and over, "Chuck, you had enough?" I hadn't had enough. Anyway, he knew I had enough. Why does he have to be? He's asking me. So I keep going to those meetings, and Patricia's kicking me out, and I'm crawling back and round and around. And she's getting better, and then she slips. She's still hanging around with me, which probably has a little bit to do with that. In any case, I'm drinking more and more, and now I'm really addicted to alcohol. This feeling that I'd had, and inside shakes during the day, I always took care of at night, was now needing to take care of at noon. Then it was taken care of in the morning, and I had to work. And I just didn't want to start drinking in the morning. I could pull it off at noon. So I would get up, and I wouldn't get up. I'd wake up from a pass out in the morning in the dark. And I'd leave the house, and I'd get Patricia's dog. She lived in the community. She had a big a Dalmatian called Chase Chance. And he'd come running out. I'd whistle the first three notes of this. Misty, and out he'd come. And we'd walk for a couple hours till the sun came up. And then if it wasn't time for me to go in and get ready for work yet, I'd go stand in the swimming pool. Just stand there with the water up to here, waiting for the time to pass. So desperately needing to drink. And then when I could, I would buy a 3-liter jug of wine every day, because that weak stomach of mine had rejected drinking whiskey anymore, because that was really toxic to this already inflamed stomach. So I was taking that 3-liter jug and pouring it into a 1-liter jug, because it's awful hard to pour out of that big one, you know. So I put it in a 1-liter and I pour. I'm trying to cut down. So I'm pouring 1-ounce drinks of wine. I'm drinking. And I drink 3 liters a day. That's my drink every 10 minutes for 16 hours. And that was not very acceptable. And finally, I just had enough. I just could not go anymore. And it wasn't working anymore. The whiskey just, the wine, I never felt good. So I had a long weekend and I quit drinking. Maybe that could have been something to do with Labor Day, now that I think of it, being a long weekend. In any case, that was September 9th, 1983, and I shook through that weekend, had mild DTs, and on Monday night I saw Joe, and there he is. Hiya, Chuck, you had enough? And I said, yeah, Joe, I had enough. Thinking, I'm done with him. Wrong. So I start, that was a weekly meeting I was going to. I start going to another meeting every day, and I go every day. I still hang out with the same guys in the same bar and everything. That was all only friends I had, but I didn't drink. I didn't want to drink. I was not going to drink anymore. And Joe told me, he says, you really ought not to be hanging out in those bars. That's not a good idea, you know, when you're in AA. I said, well, Joe, what can I do? You know, I get out of work at 6 o'clock. I need meetings at 8. It's the only friends I have. I don't watch TV. I read enough other times. What do I do between that time? He says, I don't know. I said, I'll tell you what, Joe, I'll come over to your house every day right after work until 8 o'clock. He says, look out for the trouble in those bars. So anyway, I stopped doing that, of course, after a while. I got to know, because I always did like the fellowship here. And that is, if you're new, I hope you find that enjoyable. Saved my life, as you'll hear shortly. I would say I had this fellowship. The first fellowship I had really was, there were a couple other guys like me at that once a week meeting, and we had the fellowship of people that go to AA drinking. That was one fellowship that doesn't last very long. But this one, the next one I had, was the fellowship of the parking lot, and I got so much from you guys talking after the meetings out in the parking lot and sharing the action and asking questions and telling, drinking stories. I didn't know any sober stories, so that was nice. Kept me in the interest. So I'm going along like this for a few months, or even a few weeks probably, and I see Joe, and guess what? He comes up and says, hiya, Chuck. Are you in? Are you in? What the hell does he mean by that? No, I understood that. If you had enough things, are you in? I am about to ask him what he means by are you in. I never want to reveal any ignorance. Never. So the time went by, and he keeps saying that. Hey, Chuck, are you in? And I was doing pretty well. Stopped shaking. I'm sleeping at night and developing a little honest to God fat instead of just alcoholic swelling, you know. And I was feeling good, and everybody was patting me in the back, and it was really good. And then after about a year or a year and a half or 2 years or somewhere in that range, I started going nuts in my head. And I didn't tell anybody about it. I sure as hell didn't tell my sponsor about it because I didn't want him to know. I shouldn't have picked him for a sponsor. He's in the same business that I'm in, and I didn't want to tell him the truth about anything. Well, other things that wouldn't hurt me. So I called this guy up in Jacksonville, who's a friend of Aubrey's. A lot of you remember Aubrey. And up in Jacksonville, and David T., and I told him what was going on with me, and he told me, and maybe the meetings you're going to, he says, I don't know what's going on, but I was wanting to avoid people. Somebody would walk into a meeting, and I know they're going to talk about something I don't want to hear about, probably something to do with God. And so I'd get up, pretend like I was going to get a Coke or something. I'd go in the other room. And I know I wasn't even that bad when I got there. So I knew, I'm not doing something right here. And Lord, was I right. So this guy up there told me, go to meetings. This may not be your problem, but just put this yardstick on your meetings. Go to meetings where they talk about their experience. No fancy theories, no highfalutin explanations. Experience. I got that. And number two, go where they talk about the solution, not the problem. You know about enough about the problem of alcoholism. So I go to my meeting that night. Guy walks in, sits down. I'm your chairperson tonight. Has anybody got a problem? Oh my God, that's what he's talking about. We talked about mothers-in-law. We talked about cops, jails, alimony, kids that won't talk to you. All kinds of stuff. We talked about them all the time. And I did not know the solution for my problem. I literally did not know that there was a series of steps that Alcoholics Anonymous had, besides this fellowship. They had these steps, and these steps would produce this power that was stronger than the power that I wanted to drink. It would beat the crap out of that power. And you guys had it. And how did you get it? These steps. And I called David back, and I says, they're talking about problems. He says, well, you go somewhere else. So I started going somewhere else, and I ended up here was one of the places I ended. Because this is a solution-oriented meeting place. It saves people like me. And that's just my experience. I know a lot of other people would not agree that there is such a thing as a maldirected AA meeting. But for me, for a person like me, I needed somebody who would hit me right between the eyes with this steps thing. And I told David, I said, I don't know, it'll be that step thing. I did the third step. And I thought the third step was a big deal. I really thought you do that third step, I'm connected with God after I do the third step, right? Wrong. He says, get up here and do the fifth step. So I did. And he was very expert at it, and it was just really quite smoothly done. I told him stuff I never believed I would tell anybody. And it went just fine. Of course, he had his own war stories, some of them even better than mine. And that day, my life changed. I did that this step. I went home, and I did what he told me, to do what it says in the book. Think it over. Did you do a thorough job? If you did, go ahead and ask God. And for the first time, you see, guess what? I'm in. And I realized that not right then, but later. That's what Joe's been talking about all this time. Are you in? I've been in. I've been around AA. But now I'm finally hooked up, or getting hooked up, with a higher power that knows the scoop. I mean, not that he didn't all along, but now I've owned up to all that bad stuff. And at home, Patricia was way ahead of me. She always was way ahead of me on this stuff. And she got sober again just about the same time I did. And her sponsor was Hannah. Some of you remember Hannah from down here. And she got this spiritual thing.
I don't know how she was so patient with me, but she was. And right away we started praying before the meals. I got comfortable with the idea of praying. I had never felt comfortable with that. I believe there was a higher power, that there was some superior intelligence, but a friendly, loving God that would help my sorry ass. No way. Yeah, way. And you guys showed the way. And so, you know, those first three steps, just to be complete in this thing, for me, are really pretty simple. The first step was realizing the facts, namely, I got a real bad drinking problem. You want to call it alcoholic? I call it an alcoholic before I got here. And my life was unmanageable? Yeah, sure, so it could be better. And the second step, basically to me, was, I think I'll stick around. I didn't know what all this stuff was about God, but I knew you guys had something. I think I'll stick around. You don't do anything else in the second step. The third step, I think maybe I'll go on and do these other steps. Still haven't done anything. But I pick up that pencil. And that fourth step, now I'm starting to do something for the first time. Boy, am I getting a lot of nods now. And then now I do that fifth step. And the sixth and the seventh, and I start making amends, and I need a sponsor badly to help me with those things, particularly with how to do this exactly with my kids. And there were two people that I really, three actually, that I had to go through some considerable embarrassment and soul searching and help on how to, because a lot of this, it says you don't want to hurt anybody else, and these were very close family people, and my kids would be involved, and so I needed some, but somebody called once, judicious rationalization. Don't go around showing your ass to everybody. They don't want to even see you. You know, don't talk to that old girlfriend. She'd just be fine if she never saw you again, and that sort of thing to help you through. And then these last three steps, which some call the maintenance steps. Charlie Lindenwood called it the growth steps. I believe that's the truth, though it's not a big deal. Once you get in the habit of doing that 10th step, it just sort of comes automatically, at least most of the time. I still get in trouble and get my feelings hurt and stuff like that and respond badly. But I have a sponsor, a new sponsor since Bill O is gone, who's also a very wise man who helps me with these things. And then the 11th step is the prize. That's what Bill always used to call it. And I've always thought of it that way since he first said it. If you take the first 10 steps of this program, you are awarded the prize of the 11th step. This is the 11th step for me is where I get my power. Remember it said we were powerless, and then it talks in page 45 in the big book exactly how we're going to find this power that will make it possible for us to live happy, useful lives and be recovering alcoholics, or recovered alcoholics, as some like to say, with which I have no problem. So the 11th step is the place where I can rejoice. The 11th step is the place Bill used to talk about, bring your dreams to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the place where I put my dreams. This is where I do my dreaming in the 11th step. With some supervision from the big guy. And of course, I firmly believe that he talks to us through each other. I can't do anything about my alcoholism. And you can't either. But I can do something about yours, and you can do something about mine. So there's a very, very strange kind of a thing how we can help each other. Did I forget anything, Mike?
You're doing good, buddy.
Okay. All right. So I like to look at the record. They talk in the book about looking at the record, and they use it in the context of looking at what asinine things and destructive actions that I did. But if we can look at the sober record too, and we can look back and say, boy, I really did that good, or I really did that poorly, or whatever it is. And I had the biggest opportunity I had along this line was when my wife got sick. And she was losing her mind. And the OBGYN said, she's just menopausal, she's about 50 years old. And boy, was she losing her mind. I mean, she lost it way past menopausal. And the local docs couldn't figure out what was wrong, so I took her up to Gainesville and they diagnosed a rare neurologic progressive illness that is similar to both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So she was both impaired physically and mentally. And I couldn't leave her home alone. I was still working. And so she moved into an assisted living place where she died about 4 years later. And I felt so bad for myself. I am ashamed to say, when I put her in there, that poor me, I was going to have no wife at home with me anymore. And of course, it didn't take me very long. I'm sure you guys, some of you helped me. But it took me not long at all to realize, this is not about Chuck. This is about Patricia. This is my opportunity to show my ass. What are you worth? What can you do? And the thing that I like about it today, though, I don't know if anybody actually said this to me, but it's a nice principle to be aware of, and that is, when you're in a situation, one of the things that I ought to consider is, when I look back on this 10 years from now, or 2 years from now, or 1 year from now, what am I going to think about the way I conducted myself? A lot of nods again. And that was a good thing, because I got in the spirit. Her twin sister deserted her, basically, so you can forget about that twin stuff. Although I can't take her inventory, but in any case, I certainly stepped up, and she really didn't know who I was, and she got so small, and she'd be sitting in this big chair, and I'd go there and do these little unmentionable things to make her prettier and so forth that ladies do, and the nurses would have done eventually, but she had shown me how to do that stuff while she still could. And anyway, sometimes I'd get sort of mushy and lovey-dovey with her, you know, and I remember this time she's sitting in the chair, and she's so small, and she's looking there, can't look at me, and I just, my heart just getting pulled out of me, you know. I say, Patricia, aren't you so lucky that you've got a husband that loves you and comes to see you so much? She looks at me and she says, yes, would you mind getting him for me? So is that a laugh or a cry? So I decided to laugh. And that's how the whole thing went. But that was a great opportunity. How might I have handled that if I'd had the opportunity to do that when I was a practicing alcoholic? It would have been pretty ugly. In any case, I think I've got to my end here. Just a couple of things. One, I've always liked... I didn't tell you how I scoffed at so many things when I first got here. I scoffed at my mother not drinking. I scoffed at this hookup that somehow that you guys thought God and alcoholism had something to do with each other. True, unrelated. And so many things I was wrong about that I've had to learn, and it ain't over yet. But Dr. Silkworth was aware of that type of attitude, and he wrote at the end of his comments in our big book, he said something very close to this. If you're an alcoholic, I earnestly suggest that you read this book. And if you came to scoff, you would remain to pray. And that basically is my story, right there in a nutshell. That and the fact, the big thing I like to leave you new people with is, The fellowship with Alcoholics Anonymous will get you sober, but it takes the program to keep you sober. And I learned that personally, and a lot of people before me have known that too. And I got one question for you all, and I want you to speak out and answer for me, okay? Are you in?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.